Chapter 22. In the Land of Pencils. We settled into a rambling house on 2 acres perched on the side of a steep hill. Or perhaps it was a small mountain. The locals seemed to disagree on this point. Our property had a meadow where we could pick wild raspberries, a woods where I could chop logs to my heart's content, and a small spring-fed creek where the kids and Marley soon found they could get exceptionally muddy. There was a fireplace and endless garden possibilities, and a white-steepled church on the next hill, visible from our kitchen window when the leaves dropped in the fall. There was only one thing missing from our bucolic existence. Minutes after we pulled into the driveway of our new house, Connor looked up at me, big tears rolling out of his eyes, and declared, "I thought there were going to be pencils in Pennsylvania." For our boys, now ages 7 and 5, this was a near deal-breaker. Given the name of the state we were adopting, both of them arrived fully expecting to see bright yellow writing implements hanging like berries from every tree and shrub, there for the plucking. What our property lacked in school supplies, it made up for in skunks, opossums, woodchucks, and poison ivy, which flourished along the edge of our woods and snaked up the trees, giving me hives just to look at it. One morning I glanced out the kitchen window as I fumbled with the coffee maker, and there, staring back at me, was a magnificent 8-point buck. Another morning a family of wild turkeys gobbled its way across the backyard. Living in the country was at once peaceful, charming, and just a little lonely. The Pennsylvania Dutch were polite but cautious of outsiders, and we were definitely outsiders. After South Florida's legion crowds and lines, I should have been ecstatic about the solitude. Instead, at least in the early months, I found myself darkly ruminating over our decision to move to a place where so few others apparently wanted to live. Marley, on the other hand, had no such misgivings. For a dog with more energy than sense, what wasn't to like? He raced across the lawn, crashed through the brambles, splashed through the creek. His life mission was to catch one of the countless rabbits that considered my garden their own personal salad bar. He would spot a rabbit munching the lettuce and barrel off down the hill in hot pursuit, ears flapping behind him, paws pounding the ground, his bark filling the air. He was about as stealthy as a marching band and never got closer than 12 feet before his intended prey scampered off into the woods to safety. Autumn came, and with it a whole new mischievous game: attack the leaf pile. In Florida, trees did not shed their leaves in the fall, and Marley was positively convinced the foliage drifting down from the skies now was a gift meant just for him. Only after I had gathered a mighty towering pile would he lunge, charging across the lawn in a series of bounding leaps, flying for the last several feet and landing in a giant belly flop in the middle of the pile, where he growled and rolled and flailed and scratched and snapped and, for reasons not clear to me, fiercely chased his tail, not stopping until my neat leaf pile was scattered across the lawn again. Our first Christmas in Pennsylvania was supposed to be white. Jenny and I had had to do a sales job on Patrick and Connor to convince them that leaving their home and friends in Florida was for the best, and one of the big selling points was the promise of snow. We wantonly spun a Courier and Ives image for them of waking up on Christmas morning to a starkly white landscape, unblemished except for the solitary tracks of Santa's sleigh outside our front door. In the week leading up to the big day, the three of them sat in the window together for hours, their eyes glued on the leaden sky, as if they could will it to open up and discharge its load. "Come on, snow!" the kids chanted. A few days before Christmas, the whole family piled into the minivan and drove to a farm a half mile away, where we cut a spruce tree and enjoyed a free hayride and hot apple cider around a bonfire. It was the kind of classic northern holiday moment we had missed in Florida, but one thing was absent. As we hauled our fresh-cut tree home, the sweet scent of its sap filling the van, the kids complained about getting gypped. First no pencils, now no snow. What else had their parents lied to them about? Christmas morning found a brand new toboggan beneath the tree and enough snow gear to outfit an excursion to Antarctica, but the view out our window remained all bare branches. Then, 3 weeks into the new year, Patrick ran into our bedroom at dawn and yanked open the blinds. "Look, look!" he squealed. "It's here!" Jenny and I sat up in bed to behold our vindication. A white blanket covered the hillsides and cornfields and pine trees and rooftops, stretching to the horizon. The snow was nearly a foot deep and still coming down. Soon Connor and Colleen came chugging down the hall, thumbs in mouths, blankies trailing behind them. Marley was up and stretching, banging his tail into everything, sensing the excitement. I turned to the kids and shouted, "Okay, snow bunnies, let's suit up." For the next half hour, we wrestled with zippers and leggings and buckles and hoods and gloves. By the time we were done, the kids looked like mummies, and our kitchen like the staging area for the Winter Olympics. And competing in the Goof on Ice downhill competition, large canine division, was Marley the dog. I opened the front door, and before anyone else could step out, Marley blasted past us, knocking the well-bundled Colleen over in the process. The instant his paws hit the strange white stuff, "Ah, wet! Ah, cold!" he had second thoughts and attempted an abrupt about-face. As anyone who has ever driven a car in snow knows, sudden braking coupled with tight U-turns is never a good idea. Marley went into a full skid, his rear end spinning out in front of him. He dropped down on one flank briefly before bouncing upright again just in time to somersault down the front porch steps and head first into a snowdrift. When he popped back up a second later, he looked like a giant powdered donut. Except for a black nose and two brown eyes, he was completely dusted in white. The abominable snow dog. Marley did not know what to make of this foreign substance. He snapped at it and rubbed his face in it. Then, as if an invisible hand reached down from the heavens and jabbed him with a giant shot of adrenaline, he took off at full throttle, racing around the yard in a series of giant loping leaps, interrupted every several feet by a random somersault or nosedive. Soon the kids were taking his lead, spinning and rolling and frolicking, snow packing into every crease and crevice of their outerwear. Jenny came out with buttered toast, mugs of hot cocoa, and an announcement. School was canceled. I knew there was no way I was getting my little two-wheel drive Nissan out the driveway anytime soon, let alone up and down the unplowed mountain roads, and I declared an official snow day for me, too. I scraped the snow away from the stone circle I had built that fall for backyard campfires and soon had a crackling blaze going. The kids glided screaming down the hill in the toboggan, past the campfire and to the edge of the woods, Marley chasing behind them. I looked at Jenny and asked, "If someone had told you a year ago that your kids would be sledding right out their back door, would you have believed them?" "Not a chance," she said, then wound up and unleashed a snowball that thumped me in the chest. The snow was in her hair, a blush in her cheeks, her breath rising in a cloud above her. "Come here and kiss me," I said. Later, as the kids warmed themselves by the fire, I decided to try a run on the toboggan. I positioned the toboggan at the top of the hill and lay back on it, propped up on my elbows, my feet tucked inside its nose. I began rocking to get moving. Not often did Marley have the opportunity to look down at me, and having me prone like that was tantamount to an invitation. He sidled up to me and sniffed my face. "What do you want?" I asked, and that was all the welcome he needed. He clambered aboard, straddling me and dropping onto my chest. "Get off me, you big lug!" But it was too late. Off we went, snow flying, Marley plastered on top of me, licking me lustily all over my face as we careened down the slope. With our combined weight, we had considerably more momentum than the kids had, and we barreled past the point where their tracks petered out. "Hold on, Marley, we're going into the woods!" We shot past a large walnut tree, then between two wild cherry trees, miraculously avoiding all unyielding objects as we crashed through the underbrush. It suddenly occurred to me that just up ahead was the bank leading down several feet to the creek, still unfrozen. I tried to kick my feet out to use as brakes, but they were stuck. The bank was steep, nearly a sheer drop-off, and we were going over. I had time only to wrap my arms around Marley, squeeze my eyes shut, and yell, "Whoa!" Our toboggan shot over the bank and dropped out from beneath us. I felt like I was in one of those classic cartoon moments, suspended in midair for an endless second before falling to ruinous injury. Only in this cartoon, I was welded to a madly salivating Labrador retriever. We clung to each other as we crash-landed into a snowbank with a soft poof, and hanging half off the toboggan, slid to the water's edge. I opened my eyes and took stock of my condition. I could wiggle my toes and fingers and rotate my neck. Nothing was broken. Marley was up and prancing around me, eager to do it all over again. I stood up with a groan and, brushing myself off, said, "I'm getting too old for this stuff." In the months ahead, it would become increasingly obvious that Marley was, too. Sometime toward the end of that first winter in Pennsylvania, I began to notice Marley had moved quietly out of middle age and into retirement. He had turned 9 that December, and ever so slightly he was slowing down. He still had his burst of unbridled adrenaline-pumped energy, as he did on the day of the first snowfall, but they were briefer now and farther apart. He was content to snooze most of the day, and on walks he tired before I did, a first in our relationship. One late winter day, the temperature above freezing and the scent of spring thaw in the air, I walked him down our hill and up the next one, even steeper than ours, where the white church perched on the crest beside an old cemetery filled with Civil War veterans. It was a walk I took often and one that the previous fall Marley had made without visible effort. This time, though, he was falling behind. I coaxed him along, calling out words of encouragement, but Marley just did not have the oomph needed to make it to the top. I stopped to let him rest before continuing, something I had never had to do before. The sun bathed over him, and I noticed just how much gray had crept into his tawny face. Because his fur was so light, the effect was subtle but undeniable. His whole muzzle and a good part of his brow had turned from buff to white. Without us quite realizing it, our eternal puppy had become a senior citizen. That's not to say he was any better behaved. Marley was still up to all his old antics, simply at a more leisurely pace. He still stole food off the children's plates. He still flipped open the lid of the kitchen trash can with his nose and rummaged inside. And when the skies darkened and thunder rumbled, he still panicked and, if alone, turned destructive. One day we arrived home to find Marley in a lather and Connor's mattress splayed open down to the coils. Over the years, we had become philosophical about the damage, which had become much less frequent now that we were away from Florida's daily storm patterns. In a dog's life, some plaster would fall, some cushions would open, some rugs would shred. Like any relationship, this one had its cost. They were costs we came to accept and balance against the joy and amusement and protection and companionship he gave us. Marley had earned his place in our family. Like a quirky but beloved uncle, he was what he was. He would never be Lassie or Benji. He would never reach Westminster. We knew that now. We accepted him for the dog he was and loved him all the more for it. "You old geezer," I said to him on the side of the road that late winter day, scruffing his neck. Our goal, the cemetery, was still a steep climb ahead. But just as in life, I was figuring out, the destination was less important than the journey. I dropped to one knee, running my hands down his sides, and said, "Let's just sit here for a while." When he was ready, we turned back down the hill and poked our way home.